Welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Before we get started, I want to remind everyone that we're now in our Spring Pledge Drive, and you can donate today at kboo.fm/give. Please show your support by going to kboo.fm and clicking the donate button, or texting kboo to 44321. Our goal for this pledge drive is $60,000, so help us get there by becoming a member today. Is it possible that trees are sentient beings, rather than simply the source of timber and pulp? For decades, forest ecologist Suzanne Simard has been exploring the complicated interdependent communities that are forests. She discovered that trees communicate their vitality and vulnerabilities to other trees through an underground fungal network, living communal lives similar in many ways to our own. Today we talk with Suzanne, who's just published an autobiography, Finding the Mother Tree, about a new paradigm shift that will not only protect and nurture our forests, but also ourselves. Suzanne, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me.
You write in the beginning of your autobiography, Finding the Mother Tree, that working to solve the mysteries of what made the forest tick and how they are linked to the earth, fire, and water made me a scientist. I poured everything I had into becoming a sleuth of what it takes to heal the natural world. I'm wondering, what was your path once you set on that site and to become a scientist to actually find a scientific world that was open to the approach that you had?
Oh, that's a great question. So it was kind of a crooked path that I didn't know where I was going to land with it. But I started out as a, you know, I was an undergraduate school student in forestry, and I had followed in my grandfather's and father's footsteps who worked in the forest. I grew up in the forest. And then I worked for the timber industry. I worked as a consultant. I worked for government as a scientist. And that's when I actually did my first real research, was when I was a government scientist. And I eventually left there and became an academic. And I always called myself the accidental professor because I didn't really intend to land in academia. But at the time, I was working for the Ministry of Forests in the 1990s when I did my PhD research while I was working for them. And they downsized, as happens with when conservative governments take over. They downsized their science programs, and this was no exception. And so they were telling the rats to jump ship. And so I did, and I landed at academia. And so then I was able to pursue this research with much more vigor and really focus on looking more at connections in forests and what made forests tick.
Well, you went to Oregon State University, right, for your master's and doctorate?
Yes.
I remember back in the 90s when I was spending time there that there were two wings of the forestry department. They were actually in two buildings, and they were connected by a sky bridge. And one of them had the old school forestry professors who basically were well-funded by the timber industry, who were really into cutting down all the old-growth forests and replanting them with healthy, vital trees. And this was, I was doing this project about the Biscuit Fire back in 2006, 2007. And that's when there was a lot of controversy about how to deal with, as they called it, salvage logging, or as forest advocates call post-fire logging. And then across the sky bridge were the forest ecologists. And I'm wondering, is it still that way at OSU?
I haven't been back to OSU for a little while, but it certainly was like that when I was an undergraduate, or sorry, a graduate student in the late 80s and the 1990s. And I was, you know, following the Biscuit Fire controversy because that's when those two sides of the faculty, you know, the forest scientists and then the forest management part of the faculty clashed, you know, and it became more public. But prior to that, when I was there, it was always there and simmering and there, you know, and building and building. And certainly I started out actually as a master's student working sort of with that arm of intensive forestry, like how do you grow, you know, fast plantations of Douglas fir in the case of the Oregon Coast Range. I was working in Canada, but trying to apply these same principles of, you know, very intensive management where you spray multiple rounds of herbicides, get rid of all the other plants and grow these, you know, these great big trees. And then applying that in Canadian forests. And that's what really got me, you know, going, this is not quite right, right? Because I saw, you know, the problems that resulted from that. And that led me to do my PhD on the other arm of that faculty at OSU, which was more of the environmental side and trying to understand how ecosystems worked. Moving from one to the other, or one sort of drove me to the other to help me better understand forests, because I really could see that this was not heading in the right direction.
Well, one of the big issues that your work focuses on is that there's a lot more to the forest than what we see above the ground. And it feels like at the wing, the old school wing of forestry at OSU, and I imagine it at University of British Columbia too, that they only see the forest from the ground up. So what are they missing?
Well, now I've done many experiments, and I can say precisely that about 50% of the energy and carbon in a forest is below ground. So it's you can't see it. I mean, you wouldn't know it as you're walking through the forest. We see the above ground part. And so foresters, that's what they saw as well, right? We're very visual creatures as human beings. And so that management of the forest was really focused on managing this above ground community of trees and really focusing on single trees and how they compete for each other. But in the meantime, what I was discovering is that below ground is where, you know, there's so many species of fungi and bacteria, and like there's this whole fascinating food web where nutrients are cycled and water is cycled, and there's a lot of communication going on below ground, and so not knowing that where the other half of the operation is going on, you know, if you just focus on the above ground, which is what the past people have done, you miss half the picture or more, I would say.
Well, how did you find out about what's going on underground?
Well, you know, that's interesting because as I was going back to British Columbia to work as a forest scientist in the government, at that time, we were adopting American ways of managing forests. And we were driven, or at least our government was really driven to get rid of what we called non-satisfactorily restocked land, which was basically, you know, prior to the mid-1980s, a lot of the forest management was just, we were really just in this cutting phase and not seriously doing a lot of silviculture. And that left a lot, silviculture being the growing back of the forest, and that left a lot of the land without many trees. In fact, they looked like, to the visual vision of it, was it looked like brush fields. And so they wanted to bring these forests back into production of commercial conifers. And so they adopted the American focus on getting rid of competition, getting rid of the trees that we didn't want, using all these herbicides, and created a law, a policy called the Free to Grow policy. And that policy resulted in us also spraying our forests with herbicides to get rid of birch and aspen and cottonwood and the understory plants to create these sort of pure coniferous, almost like Christmas tree plantations. And when we were doing this and the policy went into effect and all of these activities just took off in a big way because the companies were required to make their plantations free to grow within a certain period of time. And so they were aggressively spraying these herbicides and cutting out these so-called weeds. And I was observing that when that happened, that the trees, the Douglas firs, were starting to die. Not all of them, but a good portion of them. And it turned out they were getting infected by root diseases, that when you cut the birch, these diseases really take off, the birch and the other deciduous plants. And so that's what got me going. That's what got me started in looking below ground, is trying to understand these pathogens and why, you know, this forest management approach, this intensive management, was throwing the ecosystem out of balance. And that these pathogens, and later, you know, I worked harder and harder and was looking at pine plantations and found it wasn't just root pathogens. There were all kinds of infestations going on in these sort of intensively managed forests where their diversity had been really reduced. So yeah, that's what got me started on all this.
You have a wonderful description in your autobiography about learning about what is underground when your uncle's dog fell into the pit of the outhouse when you were a kid. So what did you learn from that process?
Well, you know, I was always a kid who was fascinated by dirt, and I always used to eat a lot of dirt when I was a kid. I think a lot of kids do, honestly. and so I just had this natural, you know, affinity for forest floor and soil. And anyway, so Jigs was the family dog, you know, in the greater family. And we always spent our summers on a logger's houseboat that my grandfather had built in this bay called Cottonwood Bay. And my great uncle Wilfred had moored his houseboat, which was another logger's houseboat near ours. And he had Jigs at the time. And Jigs was a curious dog and getting into trouble, kind of like me, right? I was always getting into trouble too. And Jigs was up in the woods, and all of a sudden we heard all this yelping, and we all knew right away Jigs had fallen in the outhouse. So we all ran up to the outhouse, and as my uncles and grandfather and everybody was digging out Jigs, and I was, and poor Jigs was down there, right? Like, he was like covered in poop and toilet paper, and and I'm like watching this, but also noticing this incredible, colorful place, this, the outhouse hole. It was full of reds and yellows and roots, and anyway, I just became fascinated with that. And of course, we did rescue Jigs, and he emerged from the outhouse covered with toilet paper, and I threw him in the water. But that moment of discovery was like totally embedded in me from that point forward.
So was that visualization of what's below ground, did that start to shape your understanding of what might be going on with these trees in the plantations that weren't doing too well?
Well, certainly, you know, as I grew up in these forests, it was just part of my fundamental learning about my world, was that you can't help but observe the entwining and the complexity of, especially when you're little, you're down with the roots, right? And so when I started working in the plantation forest, of course, in that plantation forestry came from clear-cut logging, right? So, and clear-cutting is still, to this very day, is the way that we harvest trees, especially in Canada. We have huge clear-cuts up here, and lots of them. And so I started as a forester in this world of clear-cutting, which was really taking off in the late 70s and into the 80s, and now dominates, you know, pretty much the harvesting we do now. And growing back these simple plantations, and I thought, this is so different, right? This doesn't seem right. This is not what I observed in the native forest that I grew up in. And I kind of knew in my heart that complexity that we were getting rid of, basically, through our management practices, that diversity was part of the problem. So, yeah, I mean, that was all part of getting me started on this quest that has consumed most of my life.
So what did you find when you started digging around in there?
Well, lots of things. I mean, these pathogens that were killing the firs and the pines and the spruces and so on, they really love to attack the big root systems of the trees. And so I remember going out with the pathologist when I was working for the government as a scientist, that the pathologist would show me that these big root systems were infected and, you know, full of fungal material, and the fungus would wrap itself around, you know, the root collar of the trees and basically slowly kill the trees. And this was such a big deal that, you know, the forest practice at the time was, prior to planting the favored species, which was Doug fir or pine or spruce, because they were commercially valuable, was to go in and actually rip these stumps out of the ground. Like taking these huge pieces of machinery, like cats and excavators, and they would grab onto the stumps and literally rip them out of the earth. And, you know, when you think of a root system of a tree, it goes far and wide. You know, they go as far out as a tree is tall, and there's lots of roots. And so ripping this root system out of the ground is extremely disturbing. And so then they would take the root system or the stump, and they would turn it upside down and put it back in this crater that had been developed from pulling the roots out of the ground, with the idea that the roots would be out in the air and the fungus on them would die, and that this would clean the plantations of these pathogens. And I remember thinking, this is nuts, right? It was costing a pile of money to do that, for one, but it was also like disturbing the soil in a big way. And I thought, there's got to be a better way. We've put the system out of balance by, you know, clear cutting and planting single species, and then weeding out the native plants, which are the early successional plants. And then we go in and we try to correct the situation by ripping these stumps out of the earth, and then spraying herbicides and, you know, creating these like kind of like baseball fields. And I thought, this is where our problems are starting, because we're not working with the natural system. We're not working with the balance of the system. And so that's when I started thinking, we need to understand this, and how can we do this differently? And that led me eventually at Oregon State to look at the below ground world and all the different kinds of fungi and how they interacted with each other.
We're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. Today we're talking with forest ecologist Suzanne Simard, who's author of Finding the Mother Tree. So let's talk about what it was that you started finding underground there that was connecting to the roots of the trees.
When I went to Oregon State, what I wanted to study was how these big pathogens that that attacked these big root systems interacted with the rest of the soil food web. And I became interested in another group of fungi called mycorrhizal fungi. And at the time, about a decade before I started my studies, there was a scientist in the United Kingdom called David Reed, Dr. David Reed, who is now Sir David Reed. And he had done this seminal study where he had grown pine seedlings in the laboratory in little root boxes and colonized them with these mycorrhizal fungi and allowed these pine trees became interconnected by this single fungus. And then it was brilliant. He then took carbon-14 and introduced it to the atmosphere of one of the trees as CO2, carbon-14 tag CO2. The seedlings photosynthesized that CO2, and then he was able to, using photographic film, trace the movement of that C14 right through the network of the mycorrhizal network that was connecting to the other neighboring pine seedling right into that pine. And I thought, you know, I wonder if this is what's going on in our forest. Maybe we've disrupted these networks. Like if birch and fir and are connected together and we've disrupted and destroyed the network, maybe that's where the resilience lies in withstanding this root disease pathogen, which was called Armillaria ostoyae. And when I went to Oregon State, they said, oh, well, you know, you can't actually study that. These are in two different fungal groups. One attacks big roots, one colonizes small tiny roots, and one is, you know, the mycorrhizas are beneficial fungi, the other ones are pathogens or parasites. You can't actually study how they interact, or you'll spend your entire PhD just figuring out the method on how to do that. And so I thought, well, you know, I think I'll just focus in on these smaller fungal networks and see what role they play in the health of the ecosystem, because obviously, you know, the pathogens were already understood more or less a lot better. And so I took the work of David Reed's and I thought, does this happen in our forests? Is it in real forests too? Or is this just like a nice little lab study? And so I went into my forest and I basically started looking at the roots and found that the birch that was being yanked out of the forest with herbicides or any way to get rid of it was sharing the same fungal species as this Douglas fir, and that they could be connected together. And so this is what I found through a series of studies of looking at the seedlings or the trees in the forest, bringing them back to the lab and looking at their roots under microscopes and eventually, you know, doing a similar experiment to David's in the forest, and found that these creatures, these fungi in the forest, were actually, you know, like conduits or pipelines where carbon actually moved between my trees as well, between birch and fir. And in fact, the more that birch shaded the Douglas fir, which was considered to be the worst thing ever because that's competition, that's why we got to get rid of these birches. It turns out that as the birch shaded Douglas fir, it also sent carbon to Douglas fir. And in fact, the more birch shaded the Douglas fir, the more it sent to Douglas fir. You know, that sort of upended our view that birches were only competing with firs, but they were actually collaborating, and that this was helping the system stay in balance.
What did the fir do in return for the birches?
Well, eventually, you know, I went back with more graduate students, so we found out that this transfer actually goes back and forth, and that actually in the spring and the fall, the fir is giving carbon to paper birch. And so in terms of just the network and carbon sharing, it's a kind of a fluid thing that goes back and forth over within a single day. It changes over growing season, it changes over years. And so it's not just one species benefiting, they're both actually in this dance and sharing back and forth. But also on top of that, though, is that maintaining a diverse community, which is what those species are basically doing. They're not excluding each other, right? There isn't one dominating the whole ecosystem, that this diversity is actually what made the ecosystem healthy. Yeah, it was essential to the health of the forest.
What role do other understory plants like huckleberry and thimbleberry and salmonberry and all those other wonderful berries and nonberries and ferns, do they also play a role in the communication underground in the forest?
Yeah, they do. And I haven't studied them quite as much, but I've had graduate students who have looked at the mycorrhizal networks of them, and they're continuing that work. So most of those plants that you mentioned, like the thimbleberry, fireweed, salmonberry, they form a kind of mycorrhizal called arbuscular mycorrhizas, which are different than what most of the trees in the forest form. They form what's called an ectomycorrhiza. You know, the pines, the firs, the spruces form ectomycorrhizas, but the understory plants for the most form these arbuscular mycorrhizas, as do some of the tree species. So cedar, redwoods, maple trees, in our forest, the yew trees, and you guys have those in the US as well, they all form arbuscular mycorrhizas. And so they actually form their own network with these understory plants. So those trees are in a connection with these other understory plants. And so they have their own communication going on. But also on top of that, you know, these understory plants are essential in succession of the forest. So when the forest is disturbed, which happens all the time, that's part of its ability to renew, there's a succession that happens. So plants will come in, sort of start healing up that land, adding organic material. Some of them will fix nitrogen, and they form a community that is sort of that early part of the healing of the forest, the early successional community. And so they play an essential role then in cycling of nutrients, cycling of carbon, building soil, building back soil, adding nitrogen, and so on. And that connection to the other trees is really essential as well. You know, they are all in this sort of interacting web together.
You talk about all the above story plants benefiting from the help of the mycorrhizal fungi. But what do the trees give to the fungus itself?
That relationship between the mycorrhizal fungi and the trees is it's a symbiosis, meaning that just means that they live together in the root, the fungus in the root. And it's also mostly a mutualistic relationship, which means that they both benefit from this relationship. And I just have to say that, you know, all trees all over the world have obligate relationships with these fungi. They have to have them in order to survive and produce seed and carry on into the next generations. It's essential for their fitness. What happens is that the tree will provide the fungus with photosynthate or energy, basically, carbon source, and that the fungus needs it because it can't photosynthesize itself. And in return, the fungus will use that energy to grow its hyphae, its mycelium, through the soil and basically pack the soil with mycelium. All the soil crumbs and pores are full of these little threads, and they pick up nitrogen and phosphorus and other nutrients from the soil as well as water, and they bring them back to the tree and they trade them in this exchange, this mutualistic exchange at the site of the symbiosis. So they're both benefiting.
Well, one of the things that's real intriguing about your work, and this is actually some of the first things that I heard about you a while back, was that you talk about the way that the trees communicate with each other. So it's not just that they're sharing nutrients, but something more is going on. So what's that?
Yeah. So of course, I mean, when I first started doing my work on this, I focused on those nutrients because that's what foresters try to manage. They try to manage resources, right? Carbon, nitrogen, water, light. We think of those as the pool of resources a tree needs to grow. So I focused on that for a long time. But then it turns out there's a lot more information going through these networks between trees than just resources. And actually, it was work that was done in China by a group of scientists. And the postdoc at the time was Yan Song, Dr. Yan Song. And she had done this work with tomato plants where they were linked by this arbuscular mycorrhizal network. And she would inoculate one of the tomato plants with a fungus or an insect. She was able to detect that the neighboring tomato plant was able to pick up these defense signals from the injured plant, and they upregulated their genes to start producing their own defense enzymes. And then when they were challenged with that pathogen or that insect, and she did many studies on this, they were actually able to resist those. And so I started looking at that. Actually, she came over and started working with me in forests, and we asked the same question or similar questions of the trees in our forests, and found out that these defense signals are actually moving through the network as well, this information about the health of neighbors. And then eventually, as my work went along and we were discovering, you know, these mother trees in forests and that they nurture their young, we eventually asked the question of, well, can they recognize, you know, the relatedness of different trees? And it turns out that that information is also conveyed through the mycorrhizal network. So it turns out there's a lot of information going on back and forth between these plants.
Well, a number of years ago, the Portland writer Ursula Gwynn wrote a book called The Word for World is Forest, and it's about a planet out in space where earthlings come and try to colonize it. The first thing they do is they basically clear cut an area and turns it into a total wasteland. But they discover that there's this energy that's like sort of coming at them, that's making them very uncomfortable. And what they finally discover is the entire planet is one organism. I think she wrote this like in 1974, 75. And I find it interesting that science fiction writers have visualized that. And of course, Indigenous people have known this for a really long time. What do you feel like you tapped into when you started proving the science of the fact that all things are connected?
Of course, I had my own intuition that things were connected, and that's what led me to make these experiments and do this line of investigation. But, you know, I think that the great thing about this is that I've used Western tools and reductionist science and then tried to bring in more complexity science later on to understand these connections and show them using isotopes and molecular tools, like these modern scientific tools that, you know, as Western scientists, we all have faith in that technique, that scientific approach. And, you know, until then, you know, the Indigenous knowledge of connection or the science fiction that's been written about wasn't taken seriously. In fact, Indigenous people were really, of course, we know, have been terribly oppressed, and their knowledge has been ridiculed and ignored over the centuries. And now, you know, my work and taking these Western scientific tools, which are actually, if you think about it, have only been developed over the last century, really. I mean, it started before that, but the separation of man from nature started, you know, in Western Europe, and then gradually really has had such a strong influence on our reductionist science and how we do things. But it's also, you know, people have a lot of faith in it, right? Our modern world puts a lot of faith in science and medicine, and it's made great strides. But I think that in having that, you know, that peer review, going through that scientific process and using our tools that everybody understands a little bit more, and saying actually what these Indigenous people saw and knew all along, we're seeing with these crude tools. I call them quite crude compared to thousands of years of observation, right? That we've invented these tools just in the last few decades, really, and made these discoveries that have been known and understood for thousands of years. And so in some ways, it's been good that these two approaches have melded together, and these two different kinds of people can understand each other better and work together to help us reimagine or reconnect with the natural world.
You're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with forest ecologist Suzanne Simard, author of Finding the Mother Tree. Once you started publishing your results of your studies, what was the reception?
Well, it was variable. I think people were fascinated by this discovery, and I published it, like I mentioned, in Nature, which was a big deal for me, especially because I'd never done anything like that. And so that brought a lot of media attention to it. You know, the media and the public embraced the idea, although, you know, I would say that the attention was pretty muted compared to now. But on the other side, you know, so I also had the academics and I had the forest managers, and the academics, it was kind of a bit of a bloodbath, to be honest. And I think because I had sort of encroached on this field of study that was really had been started in the United Kingdom in basically, I think, in the grasslands, the moors, and in small, you know, grassland plant communities. And there was a lot of controversy going on within that community of researchers that they had their own kind of wars going on about what this meant, or amongst themselves. And I came along and did this experiment in the cathedral forests of British Columbia, which are very different, with different species, different fungal communities, and found this incredible collaboration going on between the trees. And they basically said, well, it can't be true, right? Like, you must have made mistakes with your experiments. And they kind of picked it apart. Not all of them. You know, David Reed wrote a lovely review for me in Nature that explained, you know, the broader implications of the work. But other people were kind of throwing rocks at me. And I realized that I'd sort of tiptoed into this already existing controversy. I was so young. I didn't know what was going on. And I didn't understand why they were, what this vicious fight was all about. But I think also because collaboration wasn't viewed as important in ecosystems, especially forest ecosystems, you know, we were so focused on, you know, creating light, environments where there's lots of light for plants to grow, that was like, it's got to be all about competition and, you know, we got to manage the competition. And that grew out of Darwinism, which of course Darwin studied evolution and not so much ecology. And the idea of natural selection came from the idea that plants can compete and that they evolve into different niches or species through that competitive process. And so I think people sort of thought, well, that, you know, because competition dominated our thinking in evolution and then it was translated into ecology, that certainly that this collaboration isn't important. And so then the foresters, who were completely focused on getting rid of competition, getting rid of plants they didn't want, you know, they were also not too happy about this because it upended what this whole really multi-million dollar suite of forest practices were doing. And so I would say overall, after I got through the controversial part, mostly it was just ignored, right? It didn't really change the dial on anything. And I had a long period of rest. And in that period of rest, I almost thought, you know, I think I'm going to study something else that's easier, like climate change, instead of these connections between trees. And I did. I shifted over towards more climate change. But when I became an academic, the opportunity came up for me to keep pursuing this line of research, and so I did. And I have to say the controversy still exists, but I think that now I've had much more time, many, many graduate students who have, you know, repeated experiments, done more experiments, and verified those initial findings. And we've published all of our work in really good journals. It's all been peer-reviewed. And it's becoming more accepted knowledge now. And other labs around the world have also found and verified or expanded on that knowledge. And now it's becoming more mainstream understanding. But I have to say that forest practices and agricultural practices, or how we manage our resources, has not changed very quickly along with the science as it's developed.
Well, getting back to those two wings of the forestry department at OSU, it seems like the one that's the old school is very well funded, and it's funded by timber interests. I'm not sure who funds the environmental, the ecological wing of the forestry school, if anybody. And so it seems like that has been one of the obstacles to you, that you really have hit a very sore point with industry and with the way that everybody makes money. Do you think there's a possible way to overcome that challenge?
I think that there is. And so, you know, part of this problem is that, you know, the forest industry and the way we have, you know, over the last century managed forests is to exploit them for their capital, the monetary value of them, for making 2x4s and pulp and paper and, you know, these basic products. And we need these products too, right, to build our homes and to make our furniture and so on. But we overconsume. And we've allowed ourselves to overconsume, and the forestry has responded to that market like it's an endless need. And so, you know, we're chopping down our last trees just to meet this insatiable demand for wood products. In that zeal, you know, to fulfill those economic needs, we've devalued all the ecosystem services that come from the forest. And keeping in mind that, you know, forests are home to 80% of the world's species, even though forests only cover 1/3 of the land area. They're the source of 80% or more of our clean water. They store most of the terrestrial carbon, 80%. I know I keep coming up with this 80%. Like, they, even though they're a small representation of the land base, their service to our life support systems is way, you know, it's huge. It's so important. And so what we really need to do is rethink about how we value forests, instead of, you know, something to be exploited, as something to be regenerative, that that they are our life support systems, that we should value them. I think we can do that in the market model. I mean, I think the market model is kind of, you know, it's not the greatest because it's built on infinite growth idea. And so that needs to be reshaped. But, you know, in the meantime, we can use those market tools to revalue the forest. And one of the ways we can value it, you know, we could in biodiversity, but we can also value it in terms of its carbon storage capacity, which, you know, is becoming a more accepted currency, I think. And from an ecological point of view, you know, there's a danger of focusing on one thing, a service that the forest provides, but that carbon capital is a good umbrella for many things. If we can protect the carbon capital of the forest, which is really all the energy in the forest converted to carbon, then we actually conserve a lot of the other processes at the same time. If we put a price on carbon, or, you know, carbon offsets are one possible tool for, you know, rich countries or people with wealth to invest in forests, to conserve forests so they can offset their own carbon footprints. You know, those mechanisms are ways to use our current economic model system to value the forest in a different way. And I see a lot of hope in doing that. And I think that in valuing them, then the funding for research will come, right? Because conservation of forests and natural ecosystems is the cornerstone to carbon conservation as well.
Well, it seems like we have to have really different practices.
Yes.
And that calls a whole paradigm shift about the way we approach forests. And people have been yelling for years about stop the clear cutting of old growth forests. And they're still clear cutting old growth forests. How do you see maybe interweaving your science with an activism that would really promote change?
That's such a great question. You know, in British Columbia, where I'm from, you know, when I grew up, we were a province of old growth forests. Now we're a province of clear cuts. And that short period of time, even when I was in my, even 30 years ago, I would consider it a province of old growth. And so this huge transformation of basically stripping our forests off the land and all of the consequences of, you know, our flooding and loss of biodiversity, wildfires, there's all kinds of consequences to this. And people are mad, right? And now we know, you know, there's been some recent analysis to show that of the iconic old growth forests, like the coastal rainforests, where the productivity is really high, hotspots for biodiversity, hotspots for carbon storage. In fact, Bev Law at Oregon State writes about this quite a bit. Those are being selected for harvest, you know, and always have been. That's where the most valuable trees are from, and people are up in arms, and there are protests going on right now to stop the cutting of the last 8% of old growth forests that exists in these iconic old growth, like 8%, it's hardly anything left, right? And we still have the plans, they're still on the books to be cut down and replaced with plantations, and people are saying this is not right. And from a carbon perspective, it makes no sense at all. From a biodiversity perspective, it makes no sense at all to be cutting these forests down. And so then, you know, as a scientist, as I've watched in my career, our forests get clear cut and my science ignored, I'm thinking, you know, what good is this if you don't become more active with your work? You know, and scientists are always very careful not to become activists because it seems to spoil their, or people think their scientific integrity is spoiled because they've taken a position on this thing. But we're at the point now where, you know, we can't not do that. We have to put our voices forward because we are losing, you know, the basic fabric of our very being. And just like the climate scientists had to step forward with climate change, you know, there comes a point where you're losing so much that you just have to step forward. And so I'm doing that, and writing this book is one step towards that. And I'm also trying to support the activists in their protests and also support First Nations who are also grieving the loss of their forest to this big industrial machine. And so, yeah, there's a role for sure. And it's a fine balance to walk as an academic and someone who's trying to help. But hopefully I can tread that and be successful.
Well, you were talking earlier about integrating the Western scientific point of view with Indigenous wisdom. And there's a person you mention in your book, Bruce Miller, who is a Skokomish elder.
Oh.
I had an opportunity to spend a day with him a number of years ago, just before he died. I was doing a documentary about salmon. And he told me a thing about salmon that reminds me of what you said that he said. He was telling me that the way that salmon find their way home is that as they're going down the river to the ocean, they taste the water. And I've mentioned this to a couple scientists, and they don't get it. And they say, oh, it has to do with smell or something like that. But I thought there was something so simple and so direct with the understanding that salmon taste the water.
Mm-hmm.
And I was really happy to see that he's somebody that you mentioned. But why don't you talk about his perspective and how that relates to the work that you're doing in the forest?
Yeah, so important. So Soubier, he knew forests of the West Coast, as all First Nations along the coast and all over the land know their land and forests so well, and have been stewards of those environments and carrying out their responsibility to the land to provide for them and to provide homes. And so developing a relationship that was based on this respect of forests and ecosystems as, you know, as essential for our lives. His view of Aboriginal people as well is that all of the creatures, all of us are related, and we are, right? We're actually ancestors of the trees. And that we respect our ancestors and respect our neighbors and respect all the other creatures as equal to us. And he called the trees the tree people. And actually, Robin Wall Kimmerer, in her book on braiding sweetgrass, calls the strawberries the strawberry people. And that is the Aboriginal perspective, is that all these creatures are our relations, and they are worthy of our respect, as though we do our with our kids and our parents and our grandparents and our future generations. And this is an essential, absolutely essential viewpoint that is underlies our, whether or not we are going to be successful at overcoming our environmental crises, is to view ourselves not as superior or the dominion or there to exploit nature, but to be in partners as one with all of these creatures, as our relations, as they are our relations. And so that is such an important concept. And I hope that my book helps carry that message forward, so that we all see our roles more as integral, just as partners in this web of life, that we're just one of the many.
Well, you're listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG LPFM and KODX LPFM, KMUN and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. And today we're talking with forest ecologist Suzanne Simard, who's author of Finding the Mother Tree. Well, in the last few moments, I want to talk about, what is the mother tree? You mentioned it very briefly earlier, and they're also called hub trees. So why don't you explain what a mother tree is, and then tell us how we can find them.
Yeah, so they're simply just the biggest trees in the forest and the oldest. Some forests are all one age, and so they would just be the biggest trees. So when you're walking in the forest, you see the ones with the big trunks and the tall crowns. Well, they also have the biggest root systems, and because they've got so much ability to fix carbon through photosynthesis, a lot of that carbon ends up in the roots and feeding the whole soil food web. And so we went into the Douglas fir forests of interior British Columbia, and we mapped what that network looked like in these pure forests. They were uneven age forests with big old trees and small trees and all in between. And we basically took all the fungal material and all of the tree material, and we were able to identify every individual using these DNA techniques that look at what are they're called. You use microsatellites of these short sequences of DNA that can distinguish, you know, individuals. So that's not, it's not hard to tell apart an individual tree from another individual tree, but it's really hard to do that with the fungi. And so these microsatellites had actually been developed for Douglas fir and one of the fungi in the forest called Rhizopogon, which is a truffle-forming fungus. And we were able to identify all the individuals and map, you know, where they were and which individuals were connecting what individual trees. So individual fungi that were connecting multiple trees together. And so we made this map. It was my graduate student, Kevin Beiler at the time, who made the map and or maps of many forests, actually. And what emerged out of that map was that these big old trees were the most highly connected trees because they had big root systems and they had lots of fungi on their root tips. Many of them were old growth fungi because they require lots of carbon, especially these rhizopogons. And so emerging out of the map were these hubs, right? The centers of the network, the most highly connected. And you can think of it like the internet, where there are, you know, hubs in the internet too, hubs of information where information transmits out of these central points, or the airport system where there's big hub airports like Portland and Seattle and Chicago and lots of little, you know, local airports that are connected to them. Those are networks. And this was a network that was the same. And in fact, it's patterned after a neural network. Neural networks have these features where you have a few big hubs and a lot of small linkages, a lot of small nodes. And so then we started doing experiments about what these hub trees do. And we found out through a series of experiments that they actually enhance when they're linked into these the seeds that are germinating, enhance their survival, and they can also enhance their growth, and they can enhance their sort of like their nutrition, and you know, even their own networks or their own fungal networks themselves. And so this nurturing led me to start calling them mother trees. And eventually we learned that these trees could also recognize which ones are their own kin. They could recognize which were their own seed. And so that even was even more, led to even more reason to call them mother trees. And just as one caveat to that, you know, a lot of our trees have mothers and fathers in the same tree, right? There are a few trees like the yew tree where the mums and dads are in separate trees, but most of our conifers like Douglas fir have them both in one tree. And so these mother trees, you know, they actually are mothers and fathers all together.
I got a feeling reading your book that forests are kind of matriarchal. And I'm not sure if that was just your take based on your life experience, or if you actually do see that there's a matriarchal energy about forests.
I think that this connection is matriarchal. I think that, there's both going on. There's both the patriarchal and matriarchal aspects to them. Like they do compete, they do collaborate. Those tend to be male, female sort of characteristics. But it's interesting because I was talking to Randy Cook, who is a Kwakwaka'wakw chief on Vancouver Island. And he was talking about, you know, in his art, he's a carver as well. And he was talking about in the carvings in the First Nations, a lot, they have that obovoid shape that is central to a lot in a lot of the totems and longhouses and art pieces have this obovoid shape to it. And he says that's really a female shape. That's the heart, that's the hearth, right? And the color red that is used a lot in their art, and that color red also is very female. And so he was recognizing understanding himself that this femaleness was so much a part of their societies. And a lot of those nations are matrilineal societies, and they are so tightly interwoven with the forest, which have these mother trees, and they also called them mother trees, which is interesting, and grandmother trees. And so this matriarchy just runs through our forests, through our people, through the nurturing, the recovery of forests. But that's not to say that the males are also important as well.
One of the things that I learned and never realized was the importance that the trees have once they start to die. And I wonder if you can talk about what the mother tree does as she's reaching the end of her life.
Yeah, so we did a series of experiments where we were in the lab. This is interesting because actually in the greenhouse, and we were injuring trees. We would grow them as mother trees, sort of give them a head start, and they would grow big, and then we would injure them, and then we would see what happened with their energy and what happened with their messaging to their neighbors. And we would label the trees with C13 as we were injuring them, and the trees would take up that C13, and they would, as they were dying, they transmitted the energy into their networks, into the neighboring trees. Like not all of it, about 40%, but a large amount of their energy went straight into the living trees around them. And so this really, you know, it really revealed to me, you know, how dying is such a process, or the end of life is such a process, right? It's not just like, oh, suddenly it's gone, or your energy is dissipated into the netherland. The trees are actually, you know, there's a direction to that, where that energy goes. And it's, you know, to the next generation of trees and creatures that are still living in that, in the current generation. And it gave me a great more deal of respect for dying trees and the role they play in our ecosystems, that they have such an essential function in nurturing and passing their energy to the next generations. And, you know, in thinking about how we manage dying in forests, we tend to, you know, hate it, right? We hate it when trees die, or we or if there's, you know, we tend to do what's called salvage logging, where we go in and take out the trees even before they're dead. We'll take them out, but as soon as they're dead, we definitely want to take them out so we can sell them. But it's really in that essential period of dying and then shortly after death that this transition from one generation to the next is happening. And I would love to see us not be so, you know, so overzealous in trying to take out, you know, the old and the, you know, of course we're targeting the old because they're big and valuable for that reason, but we're also targeting them, you know, as they're dying and then after they die, without giving them the chance to do the rest of their life's work, which is to give back to the ecosystem.
Well, that's actually a big issue right now in Oregon. You're probably aware that there was a lot of fires last fall in the west side of Oregon. Mm-hmm. And there's been a huge amount of, quote, salvage, or as we prefer to call it, post-fire logging going on where these burns were. Mm. And one of the ones that has been of a lot of concern to people around the Portland area, because it's the burn closest to Portland, is some intensive logging that's been going on Highway 46 just north of Detroit. But I actually had somebody on my show a few weeks ago talking about how they've been clear-cutting 100 feet on either side of the road. And they're taking out not just burned trees, but they're taking out a lot of very live trees. Mm-hmm. And I wonder, I mean, people are really organizing as they best they can to stop the logging. But it seems like it's going to also go on around the Santiam River and the Mackenzie River. Do you have any words of wisdom that we can use as we try to fight that kind of clear-cutting?
Yeah, I mean, I think that they can, you know, I think that it's okay to take a few trees, but not all of them, and especially the ones that are still alive. Like, they are such an important part of these ecosystems, and they hold the soil together. They hold the soil in the ground. They prevent erosion. There's so many reasons to keep them. They store so much carbon. They're still, like, full of life, full of species. And the dead trees, too, as I mentioned, you know, they still are in the process of giving back to the ecosystem. They provide homes for woodpeckers and all bears, all kinds of creatures that use the cavities that are created in those trees. And so I would say, you know, if they can leave them, that would be the best thing. And if you want to take some, don't take them all. Take a few, but leave the rest to do their work to heal the land. I'm supportive of the people that are protesting against that salvage logging if they're clear cutting, because it doesn't have to be this way. You know, that those trees have a role to play. And sure, you can take out the ones that are maybe pose a danger to people, or, you know, like along hiking trails or roadways, or, yeah, sure, fine. But, you know, those, keeping most of that, the death intact, and certainly keeping the live ones still there would be the best approach. So yeah, I mean, I would slow right down and let nature do its work to help heal the land. And that means leaving a lot of these old trees behind.
Well, I learned an interesting thing from a tree that fell down in this wetland right near my house. And it was like half of one of those bifurcated cottonwoods, and one and a half just went right down the hill. And I thought it was dead, and then about a month later it started sprouting buds, and now it's fully leafed out. Yeah. So I wonder this is something I've really been wanting to ask you about. What kind of forces are there in trees? It seems like they live for a long time after they supposedly die.
Yeah, and well, you know, and species are all different too, right? So cottonwoods, you know, a lot of the deciduous trees, they reproduce vegetatively, which means that they can send up shoots from even after the main stem has maybe crashed, died, or fallen over, that the root system is still alive, and there's lots of buds right below the soil surface that will sprout with the new light coming in, and that's the new tree. And they have this huge root system that's been alive for a long, long time, supporting the mother tree, and that all that energy then is available for these trees to re-sprout back. And so they're very much a living creature still, even though the top is gone. And cottonwoods are especially interesting because they do this thing where the branches or stems or whole stems can fall off, and they can root in place. Like, they can actually form roots and then form a new seedling and a new tree that's, you know, the genetic material of the parent tree. And aspens have their own clever way too. They have this underground root system that even if one of the main mother tree is dead or gone or fallen over, that that causes the suckers to come up. This whole root system will sprout and form a whole new forest that is completely related, or, you know, the offspring of the dying tree, or the one that blew over. And so it's very much a living system.
Well, one last question, Suzanne. What do you think we can learn from forests?
Oh, so much. You know, I think that one of the things is this idea that trees are in these sophisticated relationships that includes, you know, collaboration and competition, that the forest really is a social system where the diversity and the, you know, the it, below ground, above ground is all part of that integrated system, that diversity matters. And I think as a human society, connection is essential to our own life. Like, we have to have connection in order to live. We have a social responsibility to each other. Trees have that as well. And that protect and uplifting, you know, the young ones coming up, the ones that are weak or maybe disadvantaged in some way, that we have a responsibility to ensuring that they contribute to the diversity of the forest community, that we support them. And so, yeah, I mean, I think that there are many lessons from the forest that we can take as societies, human societies, for caring for each other and caring for the forest, of course, as well.
Well, Suzanne, it's been really great to talk with you. I really appreciate it after reading your books and hearing about you all these years. So thanks for being on Locus Focus. I also want to mention, I think you're going to be doing a Powell virtual reading. So can you give us information about that?
Yes, I'm going to be doing a reading at the Powell Bookstore online. It's actually on May the 5th at 5:00 in the evening.
Once again, thanks a whole lot for joining us.
Thank you so much, Barbara. Great questions.
We've been talking with forest ecologist Suzanne Simard, author of Finding the Mother Tree, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KWU Community Radio in Portland, Seattle stations KBFG, LPFM, and KODX, LPFM, KMUN, and KCBB in Astoria, and Radio Tacoma. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to a podcast on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. To hear previous episodes of this show or any of our KWU Public Affairs programming, go to kboo.fm or listen on iTunes, Google Play, or wherever you get your podcasts. I want to give special thanks to the KWU staff, who are doing an incredible job of not only keeping KWU in the air, but helping all us volunteers make the best radio possible from home during this pandemic. And now, during our spring pledge drive, you can help us if you're able by becoming a member of KWU or renewing your membership if you're already a member. Go to kboo.fm and click on the donate button on the upper right-hand corner of the homepage, or text KBOO to 44321. Thanks for supporting community-powered radio. Next week, we talk with Klamath Modoc artist and activist Kaila Farrell-Smith and Hoopa Valley tribal member Thomas Joseph about lithium mining along the Oregon-Nevada border. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening. Stay safe, wash your hands, get your COVID shots, and remember to socially distance and wear a mask.